public health advisor with CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases assigned to the Oregon Immunization Program. He has 18 years public health experience, 6 in immunization. In addition to immunization, he has worked in STD, HIV, tuberculosis control, refugee health, and public health emergency preparedness at the county, state, national, and international levels. In addition to Oregon, his field assignments have included Georgia and Washington State. Carlos.
Thank you, and thanks for being here, everyone. I'm assuming that we just arrow down? Yeah, okay. I always get really impatient with speakers when I'm out in the audience and they don't know how to advance the slides. Well, I'm having my comeuppance right now. So we in Oregon, with the Oregon Immunization Program, I guess it was a little over a year ago, decided to do a vaccine finance survey of our providers in the state. And it was very much a collaborative project. We worked with the Oregon Partnership to Immunize Children, which is our pediatric coalition, and with the Immunization Policy Advisory Team, which is, well, it's fairly self-explanatory. It's made up of physicians and other stakeholders, nurses as well, that advise us on how to give vaccine in Oregon, at least on the public basis. And through these two organizations, we were able to get input on this survey instrument from providers as well, both at the nursing and physician level. What brought this about was that, we had an opportunity. You know, there's plenty of new vaccines that are protecting the public from more and more diseases. Disease incidence is very low. These are things that we hear over and over again, and challenges remain primarily or significantly in the finance area. So you're going to hear me rustling papers up here, too, because I have notes. So the challenges, the higher cost for vaccines, inconsistent health plan reimbursement, and we had a lot of anecdotal information from providers. We were hearing things in conversations here and there, very informal. And we were hearing that some providers were considering dropping vaccine practice. Well, we realized that this information is very interesting, but it's hearsay, so to speak. So we decided to have we needed more reliable information. So the way to get that was to go directly to the source and speak with immunization providers. And we began this with, we had a joint coalition, both the adult and the pediatric coalition, meeting March 13th of 2008. Lance Rodewald came out and spoke to us. And a big part of that day-long meeting, or almost day-long meeting, was splitting out into having breakout groups and having people who are actually out on the front lines giving vaccines, both in public and private settings, talk about what challenges they faced in terms of vaccine financing. And that also helped us formulate questions and to help us know what we were looking for. So, and then the final tool, or the next tool, was the survey that I'm about to talk with you about. So the methods that we used, we sent a paper survey form out to our providers, public and private, and we used certified mail so that we knew the ones that were received or not received if we had bad addresses or something like that. And things would come back to us, and then we had our staff who would actually, our administrative staff who were actually calling up providers and getting correct addresses. So a lot of them went back out and were ultimately responded to. And they had the option of responding either on paper or through SurveyMonkey online. So we had a 54% response rate out of, we had 299 respond out of 554 respondents at 698 clinics. The reason there's more clinics than the respondents is because some clinics have multiple sites, particularly the larger health departments and then some of the larger practices as well. We have a very talented research analyst who works with us, a young man who came from the private sector, and he was amazed at this level of response. He said, in the private sector, you have to give away iPods to come even close to 54%, and we didn't give away anything. So who responded to us? Well, it was, and I tried to get a little bit creative here with a PowerPoint, and rather than have bullet points, just have bullets, but we had most of our respondents were doctors, and those doctors included MDs, osteopaths, and naturopaths. For those of you who may not be familiar with Oregon, it's there's probably a higher incidence of, shall we say, alternative health care than there is in other parts of the country. So we had 35% of our respondents were the physicians themselves, 18% were RNs, and 17% were the administrators. So we had a fairly high number of respondents who were in positions of responsibility at the practices. And then you'll see that also nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, we had 9%. Now, could everybody just close their eyes and not look at this? Because this, let's just take it away, it's incorrect. We tried to make this a nicer looking presentation, and instead of having a bar chart, have a pie chart, but I take full responsibility for this, even though it was, we left out something. We left out the private providers, so I will just read off what the breakdown is. I just realized this morning and talked to one of my coworkers and got the actual breakdown. So the respondents, it was 55% private independent practices. And you're looking at the slide. Just, you know, stop. 15% were federally qualified health centers or rural health centers. 10% were public providers, local public health departments, or community health centers. 10% were hospital or medical groups. 6% were other, and other were tribal clinics, corrections, or mixed of other groups. 2% were school-based health centers, and 2% were practice networks or HMOs. Yeah. Okay, go away. All right. So of the outpatient practice types, you'll see here that the bluish shades on the left, those represent the pediatric practices. Broken down by small, medium, and large, and then in the middle is the family practices, and then to the right we have the last two, public and mixed. And I was surprised a little bit by the higher percentage of respondents who described themselves as family practice, and I think that what that breaks down to is that, and this is a casual observation on my part, but Oregon is not only very rural, there's a lot of area that's referred to as frontier. In other words, the land is not cultivated or used for livestock, it's just wild land, and so it's very sparsely populated. You'll have a practice in that, in maybe the small town in the county seat, that will have a family practitioner, pediatrician, internist, several different specialties within the practice. So even though there is a pediatrician within that practice, it's identified as family practice. So that would explain the higher number. In terms of the breakdown of the respondents, we found that the family practices versus pediatric practices really were equal to those who received the surveys. And nearly half the respondents, 47%, see less than 25 newborns per year. So there's some smaller practices out there. And about a third of the respondents report that their clinics serve more than 50 newborns a year. Of the respondents, 90% were VFC providers. And a third of those VFC providers see less than 50% of VFC children in their practice. And about half of them see less than a quarter of their kids are VFC kids. And so the barriers, let's get to the nitty-gritty here, the barriers to stocking adequate vaccine supply. Well, we have, of course, private vaccine plans, vaccine coverage. 77% of the respondents found that to be a barrier. And the way that it was broken down was very important, somewhat important, important, not important, down the sliding scale. So this number is a combination of very important and somewhat important, these numbers here. So as I said, private plans, vaccine coverage, 77% saw that as a barrier. Vaccine costs, 75%. And then the payment terms that the for the private vaccine purchase, that they would make to the manufacturers saw that, almost half of them saw that as important, yet 34% saw it as not important, which seems fairly significant as well. And then we had a similar breakdown, well, somewhat similar in terms of distributors' payment plans or payment terms. So paying for vaccine, for medium to large pediatric practices, payment terms are significantly more influential in their ability to stock an adequate vaccine supply than in family practices. I think, you know, what you can infer from that is that, you know, they just do a larger part of their business is vaccine. Clinics with a lower percentage of VFC versus private pay vaccines were more likely to be affected by vaccine inventory costs. So that seems pretty obvious because their bigger part of their practice and a bigger part of their inventory is privately purchased. So who makes the decisions in the practices? And I was advised by a coworker to go slowly through this slide. So who makes the decisions in the practices? Well, 63% of the respondents said the physicians make that decision. 13% of the administrator, 13% said their administrators make the decision. And I should clarify that is administrators only making the decisions. That we found that a lot of the administrators and the physicians work together in making the decisions on vaccine purchase. And 49% of our respondents negotiate private vaccine prices independently. In other words, they're not working in a pool or they're just working directly with the supplier. So the administrators may or may not be physicians, and the administrators had the highest rate of direct involvement in purchase decisions. So that 13% is a little misleading because a lot of them were working alongside the physicians and the partners. So in the medium and large clinics, administrator, well, as I said, I'm just, this just sort of reiterates what I was just saying, and I will just, yeah, the physician partners were more likely to make the decisions in pediatric practices versus family practice and clinics with a higher proportion of private. So let's get to the real answers here. In terms of who has seriously considered or considered in some way stopping vaccine service to private patients. And this is, you know, one thing I found out. I'm not a very experienced survey designer, and had a lot of help with this, but there's always something that you wish that, well, I found that there's some things that I wish that we'd asked differently. And I think that considered and seriously considered, I wish we could have worded that some other way, because what does considered mean? Yeah, we thought about it, but, you know, we blew it off. I mean, I just think that's not a very precise way to ask the question. That said, we had for private patients, 28% of the providers had considered in some way ending their vaccine service to them. Yet 65% had never considered it, which I think is fairly notable. And then 7% just didn't know, and that may have been a function of maybe perhaps some of the non-decision maker respondents. Answering that question. Now, in terms of stopping VFC participation, it was much lower. 14% total have considered stopping VFC participation. 82% have never considered. So we feel like that's a good sign that VFC is going strong in Oregon, which we sort of knew anyway. Of the non-VFC clinics, they were more likely to have considered discontinuing vaccine services for privately insured patients, which makes sense. Because majority of their expenditures or the majority of their vaccine or all their vaccine is being paid for by them. And they were nearly 50% more likely to do so than VFC providers were. In terms of adequate reimbursement, the respondents said for private vaccine, they felt like they were always adequately reimbursed, 63%. Sometimes, and 11% felt they were never adequately reimbursed. For administration fees, you see the numbers that I don't need to read them off to you, but 15% felt that they never got enough for administration fees. 60% felt that it was sometimes, so that's 75% of the respondents, and there's a little more information on this. And in terms of administration fees for Medicaid, interestingly, 32% felt that they were never adequately immunized for their Medicaid patients for admin fees. So smaller clinics were more likely to feel like they were adequately reimbursed by Medicaid for administration fees, significantly more than the larger ones. And clinics with a greater percentage of ESC patients felt adequately reimbursed by Medicaid for admin fees. In terms of referring their patients to the local public health department, from the, these were the private providers responding, how did that break down? So when vaccine was not stocked, when they didn't have that particular vaccine in stock for whatever reason, they were referred to the local public health department. And 24% when they found that they did not receive, when the patient was not adequately covered by their insurance plan, they were referred to another provider, to a public provider. And other is probably made up a lot of travel vaccines, that sort of thing. And 14% never referred their patients away. They went ahead and vaccinated them anyway. So administration fees, we put out some ranges. The administration fee for VFC vaccines in Oregon is $15.19, and 16% of people felt that that was adequate, kind of surprising. And then you see the range of up to about above $31, what people felt was an adequate amount. The majority, 74%, felt that current fees do not adequately cover vaccine costs, and the mean cost that they suggested or that they thought was right was between $22 and $24. And that $15.19, that is at the top. That's the most that we can do. It's at the cap in terms of publicly supplied vaccine in Oregon. So combination vaccines and Medicaid, in terms of using combination vaccines more if Medicaid offered a higher fee, administration fee than for individual vaccines, 22% said that they would give more combination vaccines if Medicaid offered more, 24% were neutral, and 35% said no. And practices with higher percentage of EFC patients were more likely to respond with no. So we had, just real quickly because I'm running out of time, we had some strategies that we put out there for them to respond to that they felt would be a good way to address this problem in Oregon. And one was to use state general funds for the underinsured was the highest, 61%. Well, I think every state, and Oregon is certainly one of them, is having budget problems, so it's pretty unlikely that that's going to happen. State tax incentives for insurance companies, for anyone purchasing or paying for a vaccine, 41% felt that that was a good idea. Taxes are not popular anywhere. They're particularly unpopular in Oregon. We don't have a sales tax, and so that's unlikely to happen. And then I'm afraid that this third one, and I'm not going to have time to explain that, that would basically be our program being a supplier, a distributor of vaccine, and offering very favorable terms. We would buy it, store it in our depot, and distribute it out to private providers who would, you know, basically get it at our cost. We'd get it through MCAP or not through the federal contract. And they'd get very favorable payment terms. And then technical assistance on contract and billing with private health plans, 14% felt that that would be helpful. So I'm not going to go into that. One thing that we would like to do in Oregon, we're trying to involve the four players that we see in the vaccine business, the health plans, the providers, the vaccine manufacturers, and us, the state immunization program, to all contribute something somehow to solving this problem or at least alleviating it. And so the Immunization Policy Advisory Team drafted two resolutions in December 2008. And just real quickly, basically saying vaccine manufacturers, please extend your payment terms up to 120 days. And one of the things that we've done since then was talk with the manufacturers and did not, you know, they give 90-day terms at this time, and that there was not a lot of interest in extending beyond that. And then also to have health plans provide access to on-the-spot patient coverage information similar to what pharmacies do to streamline reimbursement process and lessen the burden on providers and patients. In other words, when the patient presents for vaccines, to be able to go into a system and right then and there find out, ah, this child is covered for so many dollars for whatever vaccine. And we found that one of our larger health plans already, one of our larger systems already does that. And there was some interest in that, but they feel like pharmacy and medical are really two different things, and this would be a difficult thing to put into place. I already mentioned this, that we've met with the representatives of manufacturers and health plans. The work continues. I'll just add that since I put this presentation together, we had another IPAT meeting, and we have some expanded resolutions. There's actually four now. And I can get those to you if you'd like. And I would just like to acknowledge and thank the people that that played a big role in this. One of my fellow managers at the program, Colette Young, and the research analyst Scott Jeffries, who not only analyzed the data, helped us with the questions, but worked on this PowerPoint. And then Gary Fried and the University of Michigan group, so from whom we freely borrowed some questions from the survey that they had done before. So thank you very much. I have 20 handouts on the back table, not nearly enough for everybody in the room, but I'm thinking not everybody will want one. If you want one and don't get one, please send me an email or call me and I will get one to you, and it'll have the correct pie chart in it. Thank you.